She was a born storyteller at the age of 3 or 4. She would be observed holding a book in her hands, often upside down, and she would walk back and forth and make up and create a story. Her mother arranged for a play date with young friends. She would actually refuse them and insist that her mother play with him so that she could continue on making up.
That was Susan Whistler talking about young Edith Wharton. The first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for Literature, Wharton is the author of classics like The Age of Innocence and The House of Mirth. She created an unforgettable portrait of 19th century America and women's role in it. I'm Elan Verveer, and this is Seneca's 100 Women to Hear. We are bringing you 100 of the world's most inspiring and history-making women you need to hear. Edith Wharton's books continue to sell widely, even 100 years after their publication, and they've been the source for many movies, starring everyone from Betty Davis to Michelle Pfeiffer. But Wharton was more than a novelist. She was also a forward-looking designer of homes and gardens. And for her relief work during World War I, she was a hero to the French people. We got a fascinating insight into Wharton's life from Susan Whistler, the executive director of The Mount, the beautiful estate Wharton built in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. Listen and learn from Susan Whistler why Edith Wharton is one of Seneca's 100 women to hear. I'm speaking today to Susan Whistler, the executive director of The Mount, the estate of Edith Wharton. And we're going to be speaking about Edith Wharton and her place in America's literary history and so much more. Susan, it is a wonderful pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, Milan, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Edith Wharton wrote about the world of the wealthy during the Gilded Age, the late 1800s. She gave us memorable novels, including The Age of Innocence and The House of Mirth. She was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for Literature for The Age of Innocence. She was also a designer and a decorator, and her passion for houses and gardens obviously comes out at The Mount when one visits. What do you think she should be remembered for? How do you see her legacy? You have an intimate engagement with her almost every day as you're there at The Mount.
Well, Edith Wharton, I would say, is and should be probably best known for her enduring classics, The House of Mirth, Ethan Frome, and also The Age of Innocence, which is probably her best known work. It's the one that won her the Pulitzer Prize when it was published in 1920, and it hit number one on the bestseller list again in 1993, following Martin Scorsese's release of his film starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Daniel Day-Lewis, which is based on the novel. But I would say, even though she's mostly known as a novelist, her literary legacy is actually so much bigger. She wrote across many genres, including short stories, short travel books, literary essays, and poetry. And her first well-known and sort of, I would say, hit was a book that was actually about interior design. It's called The Decoration of Houses. It was published in 1897, and it's still taught in design schools today. I think she also should be remembered for taking on subject matter that I would say even today might seem audacious. Her books and her novels addressed issues ranging from euthanasia to war to female sexual desire, especially that of older women. And I would say that she and her works defy any easy categorization, I would say. And then, of course, there is what I think she considered her most important creation, or one of her most important creations, and that is the estate that she designed and built in the Berkshires, The Mount. And she was as proud of that as any of the literary work that she produced.
Just an exceptional legacy, for sure. Now, you're the executive director of The Mount. Her longtime estate, as you just mentioned, in the beautiful Berkshires, and you used to practice law in New York. What got you interested in Edith Wharton, and how did you come to head The Mount?
Well, I thank serendipity for my journey. My last legal job was actually with a firm here in the Berkshires. And the partner that I was closest with, unfortunately, died of cancer while I was there. And it was a big moment in my life. And I took that opportunity to step away from the law and decided I'd really actually rather spend more time outdoors. And I spent the next couple of years as a sort of itinerant tradesperson. I was a carpenter. I did landscaping. I did painting. Just sort of odd jobs here and there. And but I was growing tired of the, it was getting a little tiring, and I certainly wasn't making a lot of money. And a friend notified me that there was an opening here at the Mount involved with operations. And I applied on the Labor Day in two, I think I applied on a Friday in 2001 in September, and started the following Monday. And I fell in love with the property, and I have never looked back. And it's hard to believe that that was nearly 20 years ago.
It's an exceptional story, serendipity though it might be in terms of how you got engaged. But I think the Mount is very fortunate too to have such an exceptional lawyer and committed leader of that beautiful place. You mentioned at the outset some of Edith's great literary achievements, and she wrote so many years ago, and yet her books remain so popular today. Why do you think that's the case? And what does she tell us about the wider culture in terms of her time and our time?
Well, when Wharton was at the peak of her career, women's rights were arguably expanding. Divorce was becoming more common. More women were entering the workforce. And then, of course, the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1919. And despite all of this seeming progress, a major theme in Wharton's work is how women's options remain constricted. Marriage was often unsatisfactory, and of course, women continued to be treated unequally. And I would say that is one theme that runs throughout her work that continues to resonate today. And another big theme was, I would say, the huge divide between the enormously wealthy, the one percenters perhaps, and the working class. So I don't think it's hard to draw parallels between her time and ours, and I think the themes that she addresses in her works continue to be themes that we as individuals and as a society continue to struggle with. But I think perhaps the principal reason she remains popular is because she's just a wonderful writer, and she's got memorable characters, engaging plots, beautiful language, and I would say a clean, even muscular writing style. And so her work has stood the test of time, and I think a century from now, we will still be talking about her.
It's so interesting. And those two themes that you mentioned are certainly very much with us today. She lived between 1862 and 1937. What was happening then that had a great deal to say about shaping her and what she eventually would write about?
Ah, that's a great question, Milan. Well, Wharton was born into the old money New York society. Or by way of example, on the U.S. Census, her father listed his occupation as a gentleman of leisure. So this was the world into which she was born. Her family belonged to a class of people who loved art, but distrusted artists. And it was also a class that felt themselves under siege, particularly by the new money class. And because she was a bona fide member of this class, she knew it, she understood it, warts and all. She knew it intimately, and it provided her with terrific material for her writing. She was also heavily influenced by European culture. As a child, Edith had spent much of her life in Europe, mainly in France, Germany, and Italy. And it was there that she developed both her gift for languages, but also a deep appreciation for beauty. She loved art, architecture, and literature. And this is where all of those passions were ignited. I would also say that she had an incredible intellectual curiosity, and that drove her to read just an extraordinary range of books, not just literature, but she also was fascinated by science and philosophy and religion. And her library here at the Mount actually includes multiple copies of books by Darwin, whose works and theories were, of course, hotly debated in the day. So those were some of the forces. In terms of events that shaped your life, I would say World War I was perhaps the most influential. from 1914 to 1918, she was in France, in Paris, and she devoted herself to creating a complex, really extensive network of charitable and humanitarian organizations that included workrooms for the unemployed, convalescent homes for people with tuberculosis. She created hostels for refugees and schools for children. And she also wrote extensively about the war. She was one of a handful of journalists that was actually allowed to report from the front lines. And her work was so extensive that in 1916, she was actually awarded the French Legion of Honor. And I would say, mention one last thing that I would say was a big force on her life. During her lifetime, there were incredible social, economic, and even technological changes. So she went from a horse and buggy era to air travel. And I would say this progress affected her deeply and can be seen in her writing. And by the time she's in the 1920s, she was actually quite dismayed at what she saw as the commercialization of popular culture. And she wrote about this in her novels. So in The Children, for example, she makes fun of Hollywood and the movie industry. In Hudson River Bracketed, she goes after the publishing industry and specifically the Pulitzer Prize. And then in Twilight Sleep, which is one of her last novels, she turns her pen to skewer modern medicine and the wonder pills that were the rage of the day.
She was such an interesting and complicated personality, obviously. I wonder, listening to your description of her and what shaped her, it sounds like she could have done any number of things. Why did she become a writer?
Well, she was born a writer. I think she had no choice but to become a writer. She was a born storyteller. So even before she could read, she writes in her memoir that she would engage in an exercise or an activity that she called making up. And so, you know, at the age of 3 or 4, she would be observed holding a book in her hands, often upside down, and she would walk back and forth and make up and create a story. Her mother arranged for a play date with young friends. She would actually refuse them and insist that her mother play with him so that she could continue on making up. So the storytelling piece came to her naturally, and I think she was driven to write, which is not to say that it was easy. Her family, I believe, was a little bit in awe of the sort of natural and sort of driven nature of Edith to write, and they supported her as a young girl. And in fact, Wharton's first published book, was a book of poems that she wrote at the age of 16, and her mother actually undertook the private publication of that. So I think they were quite proud of her. But once she was a woman of a certain age, where the expectations were that she was to marry and settle down, I would say the tables turned for her. And at the age of 21, she is engaged to a young man. The engagement is broken for very complicated reasons, and the newspapers actually report that the engagement was called off because Wharton was, quote, an ambitious authoress and too intellectual. And that was a huge humiliation for her. And as she, even as she became, critically and a critical and popular success, she was often not taken seriously as a writer. She was frequently dismissed as either just a pale imitation of Henry James, who was a good friend, or as someone whose works were trivial because they were only concerned with the rich. And this was despite her having often written stories with working class protagonists. I would say at least a third of her works deal with people who are not of the wealthy class.
Sounds like some of the criticisms that were lobbed against her continue in varying ways today against women. That criticism of being just too intellectual strikes me as one, for sure. And I just love that image that you painted of her as a child holding a book upside down and storytelling as she's pacing around. So I think you're so right. It does sound so much like she was born to be a writer. Speaking of her work, The Age of Innocence celebrated its 100th anniversary last year. What's the story behind that book for listeners who are not familiar with it?
The Age of Innocence was written in 1920, after World War I, and after the death of many of Wharton's closest friends, including Henry James and Teddy Roosevelt. And it is set not in the 20s, but in the 1870s. And it is, I would say, both an homage to and a critique of the society that she grew up in. And it was a book that she didn't want to write. Her previous book was a war novel, and it had the misfortune of coming out just as the war was ending, and the public was basically sick of war stories. But she wanted to write another one, and her publisher said, no, we need another sort of House of Mirth-like novel of manners. And so she needed money. She, by that time, had purchased a couple of houses in France. And so she actually penned the House of Mirth in, I think, a little less than a year. And in many ways, I would say it is her most autobiographical novel. And it involves three major characters. It's kind of a love triangle story. There's a gentleman, Newland Archer, and then there is the very mysterious and somewhat socially disgraced, because she's divorced, Countess Ellen Olenska. And then there's May Wellen, the sort of perfect product of New York society woman whom Newland is expected to wed. And anyway, it's basically a love story, but again, it is in many ways autobiographical. And I'll just draw maybe attention to a couple of the reasons why I say this. Ellen Olenska is probably the most obvious person based on Edith Wharton's character. Ellen and Edith were both very comfortable and felt at home in Europe, not just because they grew up there, but also because they were both very sophisticated women. They were equally at home with fashion and as well as art. Both Ellen Olenska and Edith Wharton had a husband who seized their fortune and spent it on mistresses. In the novel, one of the reasons Olenska has returned to New York is because her husband has embezzled her money and was also notoriously unfaithful. That description also fits Edith's husband, Teddy, to a T. He behaved very badly. He embezzled over $50,000 of her money, which would be about $1.5 million today, and speculated poorly in the stock market, and also purchased a house in Boston to house a mistress. And both in the novel and Wharton in real life, ultimately they leave their husbands and live alone in Paris in apartments near the Place des Invalides. And they both entertain a steady stream of French high society. So there are very many similarities between Wharton and Ellen Olenska. But there are also similarities between Wharton and Newland Archer. And Newland represents who Wharton might have been had she remained in New York and not escaped all of the bonds and shackles of the expectations that her class put upon her. The young Newland Archer and Edith are both undeniably similar. They both are very much a part of society. They attend the opera, they go to dinners and balls, they participate in all the activities of old New York. And despite these youthful resemblances, their adult lives take very different paths. And by the end of the novel, Newland is 57, and that's the same age Wharton was when she was writing it. And this Newland is very different from Wharton, the author. He is no longer friends with writers. He no longer is dreaming of making art and intellectual conversation central to his life. Instead, just like everyone else in his social circle, he is governed by convention and he's following tradition. And in the last pages of the novel, as he reflects back on his life, he realizes that he has sunk deep into a rut. And Wharton, on the other hand, avoided all of these ruts because her insatiable curiosity never left her. At the end of her life is in Paris and in the south of France, where artists and literature and clever conversation are just a steady diet in her life. And And this is probably more information than you want, but I did want to spend a little moment on May, the betrothed to Newland. And May is the woman that high society, including Wharton's husband, probably expected and wanted Wharton to be. And while for many years she was able to pull off the dual role of dutiful wife and bestselling author, eventually it became too much for her and she abandons her wifely duties and leaves Teddy and ultimately divorces him. So The Age of Innocence, I think, is a novel that can be read many times. And each time you read it, you'll get something different. And one of the, I think, most brilliant aspects of the novel is that it is written from the perspective of the male, Newland Archer. And as you read the novel, perhaps the first time you read it, you don't realize it, but certainly on the second and third reading, you realize that he is a completely unreliable narrator. And you can't, one, he is misinterpreting signs and clues that come before him as the plot unfolds, and in many ways is completely clueless. And the women in the story who are portrayed on first read as perhaps lesser characters are actually the brilliant ones.
Well, speaking of brilliant, Susan, I feel like you're a brilliant professor of literature with that extraordinary answer. And it is enough, I think, listeners will agree, to have us all go out and pick up The Age of Innocence and read it either for the first time or for the second or third time, as you pointed out.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear will be back after this short break.
Let's talk about the Mount a little bit, where you spend so much of your time. Wharton designed and built it in 1902. For people who haven't been there, and I have recently been there for the second time, and it is just a beautiful and remarkable place. Tell us how she made it happen, how it reflects who she is, because just speaking for myself, when you walk through that front door, you walk into a world onto itself in terms of its beauty and everything it represents about her.
She came to the Berkshires. This was probably one good thing that her husband Teddy did, is Teddy's family actually summered in the Berkshires. And that is how she came to know the Berkshires. Wharton's family, their summer place was in Newport. And while Wharton loved Newport as a child, when she was free to play tennis or swim or sail or ride, once she was a young married woman, the expectations of entertainment, either being entertained or to entertain, proved too great for her. And she was, all of her time that she had hoped to devote to writing was taken up with societal duties. And so in 1901, she and Teddy decide to leave Newport, and Wharton comes to the Berkshires. They find a beautiful 113-acre property, which had been previously farmland, and they purchase it. We've got a wonderful photograph, a historic photograph of Teddy and Edith, and they were both huge dog lovers, and they're like three little dogs, and they're all standing on this rocky mound, pointing as if this is they're telling the person who's taking the photograph, this is the place, this is what where we are going to build our home. And Wharton had a huge interest in both architecture and landscape design, and so she was involved heavily in every aspect of the construction of the estate. And she intended that it would be a home that would meet all of her needs, both as a designer, as a gardener, as a hostess, and most importantly, as a writer. So one of the most distinguishing features of the Mount, there are a few. One is that it is built far, far away from the roads. It's not even visible from any of the main highways or arteries. And that's because she really wanted it to be a retreat. It was not built to be a symbol of her wealth, though at that point she was a very successful writer and her wealth was considerable. It was meant to be a place where she could retire from society should she choose. It's a very beautiful and elegant house, but in terms of the number of people that it will accommodate, it's actually quite small. The dining room is designed to seat six, and there are only two guest bedrooms. And so it was, again, its primary purpose was to entertain at most your most intimate friends, and then also to give her a place where she could create. She was very proud of the mount. There's a 1905, 1906 letter that she writes to her lover, Morton Fullerton, where she actually says, and I know this line by heart, but quote, "Decidedly, I'm a better landscape gardener than novelist. And this place, every line of which is my own work, far surpasses the House of Mirth." And just to put that in context, the House of Mirth was the runaway bestseller of 1905. It was published, I think, in October. And in the remaining months of the year, it outsold by enormous amounts every other novel that had been published that year. So the Whartons, unfortunately, only lived at the Mount for 10 years, but it was a transformational decade for Edith. She had many professional triumphs and much emotional turmoil. It was during her period at the Mount that Teddy's mental instability really began to take hold. I think it was probably not easy for Teddy to be Edith Wharton's husband. He was not her intellectual peer, and he had really not a lot to bring to the table. And as she grew more and more financially successful and independent, I think he began to resent it, and that resentment began to manifest itself in ways that were not healthy or good for either of them.
Well, she clearly thought seriously, and that description that you pose, that comparative with House of Mirth to her own house, she cared about interior design. Clearly, she cared about gardens. She cared about decorations. She wrote about it. How would you describe her design philosophy if she had one?
Oh, she certainly had a design philosophy. And what she was advocating for, and it is the basic premise of her book, The Decoration of Houses, is a return to what she termed as the classical style that you would find in Europe, characterized by symmetry, balance, and proportion. Those were the three main tenets of any good design. And you had to pay close attention to how houses and gardens were to be used. She grew up in the Victorian era, and then I would say the Victorian era was characterized by houses that were over upholstered, over draperied, full of bric-a-brac, and they also gave rise to what were sort of very ostentatious properties of the newly rich, who built their houses to basically show and flaunt their wealth, and they. The big houses of the Gilded Era, the Berkshire cottages, I would say many of them put a greater value in how showy they were versus how functional they were. And for Wharton, she was always very keenly attuned to the fact that houses are, in fact, first and foremost meant to be lived in. She also felt that the house, the gardens, and the landscape should all be in harmony, and that the transition between one and the other should be gradual. But the harmonious component was not unlike a great work of art. And that is how she viewed house and landscape design.
Mm, beautifully said. Now, you've had a major impact on the Mount in many ways, but one was certainly to retire its debt, which was no small feat in 2015. That was really extraordinary. And you have managed to get some of Wharton's books returned to the library, where they have their special place now. Tell us about that and why those books are so important.
Oh, another wonderful question, Milan. Thank you. The books, yes, we have all that, what we believe to be, perhaps not all, but the majority of what remains of Wharton's own original library. It's about 2,700 volumes. We know that her full library was actually far more extensive than that. She bequeathed it to two godsons. Half of it ended up being destroyed in the war as it was waiting on the docks of London to be shipped to America for safety. But the other half was bequeathed to the son of Sir Kenneth Clarke, the great historian. and they sort of languished and were protected throughout the war in Saltwood Castle, which was out in the English countryside, and eventually ended up in the hands of a bookseller who became so fascinated with Edith Wharton that he spent probably 30 years of his life trying to continue to collect what I would call the orphans and the strays that had been perhaps loaned by the Clarks out to other people. And he was very keen on making sure that the collection remained together as a whole. And the reason why he was so keen on that is because Wharton was a very active reader. And she annotated her books. She wrote notes in the flyleafs. She underscored. She used exclamations. When you look at all of these markings, it's like you are reading the book with her, alongside her. And it just tells you so much. She also, the books, many of the books are gifts from some of her closest friends. For example, Teddy Roosevelt and Henry James. And their intimate inscriptions, as they gifted books to her, tells us a lot, or gives us insights into the nature of their relationship. For example, how much humor there was in the kind of repartee that Wharton had, particularly with Henry James, but also with Teddy Roosevelt. And so we really consider the books as the heart and soul of the property. And they also attest to the incredible breadth of Wharton's curiosity. In addition to literature, gardening, travel, there are numerous volumes on history, philosophy, religion, and science. The breadth of the books, I mean, we have books that she was given as a child that were given to her by her brothers, for Christmas. And then we also have the books that she was reading, you know, within months of her death. And we know that because the publication date of the book was, you know, just 2 months prior to her dying. And so it's been just an incredible tool in deepening our understanding of Wharton. I would say her personality practically springs from the pages. And so it's just a wealth of information for the next generation of scholars and storytellers, and we actually are regularly welcoming scholars who come to peer through the pages to see what little tidbits of information they might be able to glean.
It's really a very, very special part of the house to see those annotated books and to read the inscriptions. You do feel like you're learning something that nobody else knows. It's really an insight into her. Congratulations on being able to get those books returned so that they could be at the Mount today. We're closely running out of time, and I wanted to just ask about one of the aspects of her life that's really less well known. You alluded several times to her years in France. She lived there before World War I. She worked with the Red Cross during the war. She was even awarded the French Legion of Honor. What was it about her devotion to France and what it meant to her?
Well, I think the love of France probably was seated deeply in Edith when she was a child. So from the age of 4 to 10, the Whartons spent most of their time traveling around Europe. She spent a great deal of time living in France as well as Germany and Italy. And she was fluent in French, and she was deeply engrossed in, and I would say influenced by, French literature. So her library includes all the French greats, from Balzac to Voltaire, and so a huge impact there. But I think it actually was probably World War I that really cemented her love for France and the French people. When the war breaks out, she's actually in England looking at a property to possibly purchase. And there's some just really beautiful letters that talks about the anguish that she feels because she's unable to return because the borders have closed, and it takes her several weeks or maybe even several months before she's actually admitted back into the country. And she's just absolutely horrified by the carnage and the devastation, and then of course 1914 to 1918 she throws herself into humanitarian work on the part of France and the French, And I think I think that's where her love and her loyalties shifted. And I also think she never was that comfortable in the United States. She hated New York. She thought it was deplorably ugly. She did not feel accepted in Boston, where she was deemed too fashionable. And she just loved the layout and the architecture and the sensibilities of the European cities, particularly Paris. And so I think that's why. And then, of course, towards the, I would say, in the latter third of her life after the war, she is continuing to write prolifically. But I would say her first passion at that point becomes gardening. And she purchases this amazing ancient wreck of a chateau on the Riviera, and purchases an entire hillside that goes with it, and then throws herself into gardening, and is credited in part with actually creating the Mediterranean garden. The English were starting to settle on the south of France. The French had no particular interest in gardens, but the English had a passion for it. And so she developed a small group of very close friends, and they took the Mediterranean garden to really put it on the map as a genre of gardening. So that also, I think, was important. And I believe she felt that France, where women and men engaged in society and conversation together, that France had more respect for women and educated them actually better than America did. And so I think she felt in some ways that the French were superior to the Americans in terms of how they organized and structured their lives.
Well, I regret that we can't keep talking about Edith for hours more, because she is both a fascinating figure, and you are wonderfully descriptive in giving us insights into who she was and what she did. But before we let you go, Susan, how can listeners visit the Mount? Do you have ongoing events and programs? And if you do, how can we learn about them?
We are open every day, 7 days a week, between now and the end of October. And then we are open on weekends. We've got a wonderful website, edithwharton.org. There are numerous ways you can experience the site. You can take a guided tour with a person. You can take a self-guided tour, or you can take an audio tour. We have a beautiful cafe on our terrace, which you can enjoy sort of good food and incredible views. And then we also have just an ongoing roster of programs that include a sculpture exhibit across about 50 acres, 30 large-scale contemporary pieces. We have a lecture series that runs through the end of August. We have concerts regularly. We often have theatrical performances. I think we've got an opera performance scheduled. There will be a spoken word festival in September. Starting in November, we will be launching the second year of Nightwood, which is an immersive sound and light show that you can experience through the grounds. And that is incredible. And again, the best way to figure out and plan your trip is to visit our website and to sign up for our e-newsletter. And you could also follow us on social media. We have a hashtag @TheMountLenox.
Well, thank you so much, Susan Whistler, for this just wonderful conversation. Your great ability to enable us to come to know and be much smarter about that great literary giant, Edith Wharton. And thank you, too, for what you've been doing over the last many years to make the Mount come alive and be that very special place that it is. It's so great to have had you with us today. Thank you.
Milan, thank you. This has been lots of fun, and I hope I haven't talked too much.
No, it's been terrific. Thank you so much. I learned so much about Edith Wharton in talking to the remarkable Susan Whistler. Here are three things I took from that conversation. First, Edith Wharton remains popular today, more than 100 years after publication of her most famous novels. And no wonder. She writes about women trying to find their way in a culture that wants to constrain them, and about the expectations our friends and family place on all of us. Her novels are compelling and timeless. Second, it's also worth looking at the other side of Edith Wharton, the house and garden designer. Check out a copy of her 1897 design manual, The Decoration of Houses, for guidelines that never go out of style. Finally, if you're on the East Coast, try to visit The Mount, the magnificent estate that Edith Wharton built in Lenox, Massachusetts. Besides touring the house and grounds, you can enjoy nature walks, lectures, sculpture exhibits, music, and even lunch on the beautiful terrace. To learn more, visit edithwharton.org. Tune in next Tuesday to learn about our next featured woman and discover why she's one of Seneca's 100 Women to Hear.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear is a collaboration between the Seneca Women Podcast Network and iHeartRadio, with support from founding partner P&G. Have a great day.